So we're talking about precision today. And as photographers, I think it pays to be precise about what we do. And the reason I want to talk to you about precision is because it's something that I hold very near and dear to my heart. It's something that it's a philosophy that I live by, really. And it's something that governs a lot of my actions, my thought processes, my decision-making in everyday life. So it's not isolated, certainly, to photography. So I'll start off with a backstory why I wanted to talk about this. If you've heard of the episode with the glider incident, you've also, you've gleaned that I'm obviously flying remote control gliders and whatnot. And so yesterday I had some time. I was flying out there and I was taking pictures. I was taking video of myself flying in one hand, and then with the other hand, I was controlling the glider. Mm-hmm. It's not a good idea. This is already going to go badly. So as you can imagine, as far as precision goes, you can expect a lack of precision on either the video capture part or the control part of the glider. I actually have the video of it. And one of the things I was very unimpressed with was half the time you couldn't see the plane. I mean, I was all over the place with the camera. Obviously, my priority was the actual control of the plane. But even then, it was compromised because I was trying to do two things at the same time. Now, long story short, I don't consider it a crash. It was a kind of a hard landing. And due to the construct or the design of this specific glider with a very heavy nose and made out of foam, it kind of split the nose in half. And of course, previous damage didn't do it any favors. Now, what's the point of all of this? So you crash the glider, big deal, whoop-de-doo. I picked up the pieces, which included a battery, a receiver, for the servos, and then, the nose pod, and of course, then the rest of the glider with the wing and the tail and all that. So there were like four big pieces. And I managed to overlook the canopy hatch, which is a cover. It's a piece of foam that maybe weighs all of 3 ounces. And all it does is it just covers the hole where you're putting your battery and your receiver in, just so that it's covered, first of all.
Okay.
It's held down by little magnets, so it doesn't require a lot of force or anything. It's just a cover. It's just a piece of shit, really, is what it is. And it's not absolutely necessary for flying, but without it, how are you going to cover your canopy? How are you going to it doesn't look nice, functionally it does affect the aerodynamics when it's not covered, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's like having your windows down or your top off, right?
Right.
And so there is that. I mean, I could still fly it. I could put tape over it, but now every time I need to unplug the battery, replug the battery, now I've got to fucking mess around with tape, right? So I somehow didn't pick it up. I left. And now I spent maybe 30 minutes rummaging through my bag, racking my brain, trying to figure out if I had taken it or if I had picked it up off the ground. And I don't remember seeing it. I don't remember getting it. And all I can deduce is that it's still up on the mountain somewhere in the dirt, and hopefully hasn't blown away because it weighs like 3 ounces and the winds are fairly large, fairly strong. So the effect that it has on me when I do something like that, which is to make a mistake, not the crashing part. The crashing happens. Crashing is shit happening. Crashing is fundamental to learning. But not picking shit up, not remembering to get all the pieces is it's very costly. It costs you a lot of time, if not money, to replace. I got a quote on just trying to replace that one little part, and they're like, dude, we don't have that part. We're gonna have to sell you the whole body of the plane, which is gonna be like $35. I'm like,
that's terrible.
It should really only cost like $3, right? So now you're looking at actual monetary expenses. Or if I got to go look for that piece of shit, it's like an hour and a half to drive out there, walk up the mountain, look for it. And it's just a mistake that if you had spent 20 seconds just doing it right the first time, you wouldn't be in this mess. And that comes down to just carefulness and being precise and being on point.
Paying attention to details?
It's attention to details. Okay. And in this line of business, especially as a photographer, you know, it pays. It pays to be precise. Now, before I get into all the photography examples, let me tell you, when I say mistakes can be deadly, they can be deadly, right? So, in more ways than one, I'll give you a couple examples. You've heard me talk about almost drowning.
Mm-hmm.
That is a mistake based upon imprecision. The imprecision was looking at the size of the waves and then estimating that I could go and mess around and overhead, double overhead waves. That is very imprecise. That's okay. Not, if you were accurate about your ability and at what height of a wave, you can make better decisions, not go out there. The other thing with accuracy and precision is when you're talking about drowning, it's a second difference. That's all it takes. It's a fraction of a second. So it does matter, meaning that every little bit, you know, all the things, the small things, they really do add up. And I remember another example. I mean, a lot of things that have to do with precision are physical. That's what it amounts to. I remember in like sixth grade, they taught us about systematic error versus random error. And I'm like, what's the difference? Well, if you imagine trying to, you know, everybody's played a little golf, even at, you know, putt-putt, you know, like at the local putting, you know, putting range or putting green rather. So if you imagine if you're trying to putt into a hole, systematic error is when you try to putt, all of the balls wind up like a foot to the right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you're off by a specific amount of distance,
yeah,
and in one direction. It's just that systematic error where if you just shift it over a foot, you're going to land all your balls in the hole, right? That's systematic error. Now, random error is when you putt 10 times and your balls are kind of scattered around the hole, but not in any specific direction. It's not left, it's not right, it's not too long, it's not too short, it's around the hole. And you can't say, oh, well, just shift everything over here, you know, left like 2 degrees, or, you know, oh, just don't, you give it like 95% power instead of 100% power. There's no way to resolve that because everything is all over the place. It's random. That's why it's random error.
There's no clear plan of how to adjust or fix.
You can't, because it is random. When we're talking about precision, you can't resolve random error. You can't, because that's just the accuracy of the tool that you're working with. Sometimes it's the putter, sometimes it's the golfer. If you're talking about archery, you know, maybe it's the bow, maybe it's the arrow, maybe it's the type of bow, maybe it's the shape of the bow, maybe it's the shape of the arrow. There are all sorts of different things going on. You can try to change them up and get better accuracy, better precision, but it isn't a simple fix. That's the point. So I can't ask people to go and just, you know, first of all, there's nobody's perfect. People are going to make mistakes. But what you can do is try to resolve systematic error, systematic inaccuracy. So a lot of times, like, for example, I get upset when people can't spell. They can't, you know, put together proper grammatical sentences. Well, that to me is a systematic error. That can be resolved. You can learn how to spell. You can learn how to spell check. You can be more careful. You know, don't, like, you know, with the whole Corey thing, like, I wouldn't have caught that person if that person knew how to spell, if that person knew how to speak properly, right? But it was a lot of the acronyms. It was a lot of the no capital letters at all. Not the beginning, not the new, at the beginning of a new sentence, nothing. No punctuation, no grammar. It was that kind of inaccuracy that really created a stark difference between Corey, real Corey, who knows how to spell and knows how to speak properly and is very well-spoken, and fake Corey, who's probably, like I said, if I had to use that kind of texting, I would probably guess somewhere between 15 and 20 years old, and someone who's very young, but also perhaps undereducated. And that's the thing you don't want in a professional environment. You don't want your imprecision and your inaccuracy to be a reflection of who you are professionally. And that's not even talking about photography. That's just talking about being on time. It's talking about how you dress. It's talking about how you speak, how people perceive you. If you're a slob, people are going to treat you like a slob, you know? So I was, you know, I, you know, I give Keith a hard time sometimes about mistakes, little mistakes, grammar mistakes, spelling mistakes, because I don't want that to be a reflection of him or us, right? And that's professionally. But another example is when I used to play badminton in high school, I remember there was this one game. It was a pivotal game. It was my senior year. And the previous year in junior year, I was like the fucking hero. I won a game against a guy who I shouldn't have been able to beat. And that guy, after the round robin, he was like 3-1. I was like 1-3.
Okay.
And
at that point, you guys are going to play each other?
Yeah. And I was going to play, and I'm like, how am I going to beat him? He's like fucking ambidextrous. He's got mad hops. He's really athletic and stronger. He's just better at everything than me. I beat him because I wore him down. He didn't have good endurance. That was the only thing that he didn't have. And so I kind of broke him psychologically, and that's how we won. Our team won the tournament. But fast forward a year, and now, again, right, coming off of the heels of having won last year, now the expectations were high for us to win this year. And I was playing a guy from Bangkok who I had lost to the year before. He was one of my three losses.
Oh, okay.
Kicked my ass last year, but
is it 1-on-1?
Yeah, it's 1-on-1. Okay. I was playing singles, yeah. Men's singles, first seed. And he kicked my ass last year, and then in the round robin this year, I beat him, I believe. And then in the final round where we're playing each other for the championship, kind of like the last couple games, I remember that I was off just a little bit. Like, I remember hitting the ball or hitting the bird out 3 to 5 inches every time.
Why do you think?
Every time. And I think it was because the bird was fast. And unlike tennis, where you can't change the ball,
yeah,
birds have feathers. And, the proper term is shuttlecock, but we call them birds. The birds have feathers, and you're allowed to, if both players agree, you're allowed to break some of the feathers to bend them and to slow them down.
I had no idea.
But I'd been so straight by the book. I'd always been more about, okay, fine, I'll just like pull back a little bit, you know, maybe like just a tiny bit so that I'm not hitting the ball out or hitting the bird out. But I've never gone in broken feathers. I just don't do that. That's not me. Also, I generally like a faster bird.
If you break them, it goes slower because it's not as aerodynamic.
Exactly.
Okay.
It creates more drag, and then it doesn't go as far. And I'd never been one to do so. And then in that game, I was just hitting the ball out like 3 inches, 5 inches, and it was just, I was beating myself. I mean, and then, you know, I couldn't not hit the ball out. I just don't know what was going on. I just kept hitting it out. And having played that many games and with that many different birds, it was very clear in retrospect that I should have slowed it down. I should have broken a few feathers. I should have just tempered it, because 3 to 5 inches, that's all it takes. That's enough for me to know. For example, if I were playing someone and that person was hitting it out 3 to 5 inches, I know it's going out. I know it's going out if it's even going out by 2 inches.
You can see it when it's in the air.
You can
know.
Feel it, okay, because I know how far I am from the baseline.
All right.
Okay. So just like in tennis, I mean, I know the ball doesn't have to hit the ground before I know it's out. I know it's going out, you know, with really, really good precision and accuracy and consistency. Because also, unlike tennis, where you do let the ball bounce, you don't get to see it hit the ground. It's like volleyball. If it hits the ground, the point, that ball is dead.
Sure.
That point is over. But you better be right if it was out, that it was going to land out. Otherwise, you've lost the point.
Like volleyball.
It's volleyball, right. Unlike tennis, where you know, you see the ball hit the line and then, you know, you call it in or out. Well, that's after the fact. So 3 to 5 inches, that's all it took. I lost that match. We lost the tournament. It was a hefty price to pay. Just, you know, 3 to 5 inches, not being able to consistently keep that bird in. So that's another example of precision really coming back and biting you in the ass when you don't get it right. And the last one I think I'll give is you know, again, a lot of this is rooted in physical, the physical world, because precision is very oftentimes a physical thing. So when we talk about cycling, we talk about racing, we talk about, like earlier we were talking about, how long can you go without water, right? Mm-hmm. To know how long you can run or ride without water requires you to know how much water that you can absorb on a ride and run. Also, it requires the knowledge of how much water you are using during a physical, any, you know, exertion of physical activity, depending on the intensity and also the other variables such as temperature, such as humidity, such as your sweat rate. You know, everybody's chemistry mm-hmm. is a little bit different. So
understanding your own equipment. It's
and it's a very precise thing. And so when you look at professional triathletes, the amount of sodium in their drinks is not a mistake. They don't buy Gatorade. Mm-hmm. They mix their own, or they do buy Gatorade and they know exactly how much they have to drink in order to stave off dehydration and then the crippling performance degradation of, you know, again, of heat, of not having electrolytes in your system, of you know, high humidity and high sweat rate. So these people, what they have to do is they have to know, given any given, on any given day, let's say you have a race a month out, mm-hmm. or let's say 2 weeks out, where you can somewhat accurately gauge and predict the weather, humidity, temperature, distance, time, my sweat rate, and how I feel. Of course, all of those are variables, but then be very precise about how much Gatorade or how much electrolytes do I need to take in, how many liters or milliliters of water do I need per hour to be able to maximally perform during this race. And that's precision. And that's something that I think people need a lot more of in order to do well in everything. Not just, you know, because look, the alternative is a small miscalculation is like me walking the wrong direction looking for my glider. Like 100, 200, 300, 400 yards down, I'm going to be off by a lot.
Sure, sure.
I'm going to be way out in left field when my glider was way, way, way over on the other side. Like you were saying, when you're like teeing off and you're driving the ball down the stream, just being off like 2 degrees, your ball's going to be 30, 40 yards off in one direction.
Yeah, you're hoping that it's close to the area that you're looking for. If it hits a rock, if it hits the ground in a weird way,
right.
It could go a completely different direction. You're hoping that you can narrow down your search the best you can with the tools that you have and knowing yourself really well.
Exactly. But knowing yourself is a big part of that equation. And I get it that a lot of times when we are doing this, you know, whether it's photography or not, it's learning about ourselves, which is why practice is really important, which is why testing for photographers, if we're talking about photography, is really important. It is making sure that you iron out all those kinks before you step on, you know, at, you know, get to bat and you know, actually have real pitches thrown at you. So I wanted to lay that out because it's such a big deal to me. I mean, I literally beat myself up. I am really upset. I get really upset when I make little mistakes that cost me that much in time, because really it doesn't pay. You know, I mean, if I just spent 20 seconds to be a little bit more careful, be like, okay, do I have everything that I, you know, that I crashed, you know, the plane, you know, like, did I pick up all the parts? And if I had just gone down the checklist,
mm-hmm.
right? It's being careful. It's being attentive to detail.
Calculated.
And look, same goes with when I'm picking models. So transitioning over to talking about photography, I've learned when I'm not careful about picking models, I get burned. Makeup artists and I are sitting there, you know, scratching our heads, wondering when the model's going to show up.
What signs to look out for when you're actually having a conversation with them or interacting with them?
Now I know
what kind of person they're going to be, if they're going to be on time, if they're going to be hungover.
I can smell a flake from a mile away. And a lot of times it has to do with the precision of that person's ability mm-hmm. to text back. If I text them, I don't hear back from 6 hours. I already know. I've got someone who's not really limited by the constructs of time and responsiveness.
Not now, seeing what the opportunity is.
And yeah, that person's not going to value my time the same way that someone else who's very eager,
mm-hmm.
very responsive, you know, very excited. You can tell by the way that they're texting that, you know, the word choice, that they're very, very you know, they're looking forward to it, that's going to be a different experience. So right off in the beginning, if, you know, now I know due to sensitivity that is built up over time, someone who's very eager and excited and texts back very quickly, that person's probably going to be on time. That person's going to be reliable. That person's going to be the one who shows up. And I'm not going to be sitting around with a makeup artist scratching our heads wondering when that the model's going to show up. So
it's practice, is it being just aware?
It's sensitivity.
Okay.
It is. And precision and sensitivity really go hand in hand, because in the beginning, I didn't have that sensitivity. I thought, hey, she answered me 2 days later. Great. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely this shoot's going to go great. Nothing's going to go wrong. Right. And over time, you know, the ones that are kind of,
you see the pattern.
It's a pattern of behavior. Mm-hmm. And it's one that you, once you develop that sensitivity towards that, you can develop the precision to remove that systematic error out of the equation and get rid of people who are like that. It's not just models either. It's just people in general. I mean, if you have friends that are late like 15 minutes all the time, you tell them that we're meeting 15 minutes early and then you show up the actual time that you're supposed to be mm-hmm. there, because that's what you got to do. Otherwise, you're sitting there all the time waiting for this guy for 15, 20 minutes. Some of my friends show up 30, 45 minutes late. I never show up on time for those guys anymore. I show up systematically 45 minutes because I know that's their thing. That's their MO. They don't get ready. They don't leave the house until it's like they have to be in a rush.
Right. They don't value it.
They have to be late in order to leave the house. I don't know. Those type of people I don't get, because they put themselves in that position. They make themselves late. And the only way to get them to leave the house is like a fucking fire, that they're late already, or that, right. You know, it's already past the time that they were supposed to be there. And then they're always apologizing. Well, I know better.
Do you think they're late
now
for everything, or yeah, are they just motivated by different things? Like,
I don't know that guy or the people who I'm talking about are late for work every day. But I have to imagine that this is not isolated to only social encounters. I do think that they're late for everything.
I think it's a motivation thing. I think it's what motivates that specific person. Some people appreciate it and can see it in other people, and they respect that. And other people don't care as much.
I mean, I think there are a lot of different reasons for why someone is late. You know, you can say it's lack of consideration. You can say it's, just like they think they're too important. You know, they're very narcissistic and they want to be like make an entrance. There's all sorts of different reasons. But I do think that becomes a pattern of behavior, that if I'm accurate about removing that systematic error for, then it'll never disappoint me. So a lot of it is trying to protect myself, right? Mm-hmm. Protect yourself and make sure that you're never disappointed, like with the models.
But it's finding your own line, right? Because eventually you can eliminate everybody. You know, everyone eventually you can eliminate. So what are the things that you hold sacred or you right. value, and try to find the people that have those same values? Because eventually, whoever's signing up for whatever they're signing up for, that you can find a fault. It just depends on, okay, well, what are the most critical things?
There's a reason to get rid of anybody. I've said this in the past. I'm always looking for a reason to say no and to shooting a certain model, whether she's too tall, too thin, too, you know, whatever, too this, too that, you know, doesn't have this, does have this, or has too much of this, or whatever. I don't know. You can fill in the blanks with anything, but at some point you're going to eliminate everybody. And that's no way to go to. You have to have boundaries. And specifically the ones that I'm talking about are the ones that protect photographers from making huge mistakes about wasting time, wasting money, you know, sitting around, you know, getting stood up.
As a photographer, what do you think the most time that you had to waste based on something that can be easily solved now, that you look back and you're like, well, where is that time? Where does it go?
I think the amount of time that you spend waiting for someone pales in comparison to the time that you spend retouching. So I will say that if you're more judicious about finding someone who doesn't have blemishes or stretch marks or those things that routinely take up a ton of time in post-process, bad skin, if you just spend a little time making sure the model doesn't show up with those issues, I could save myself hundreds of hours.
Yeah, value in your own time. As if you looked at your own work as a photographer, as an organization, a company, like what dead weight are you cutting out? And if you can get yourself to a point where I can cut down my photoshopping time afterwards, after the shoot, how is that done? That makes so much sense to me.
I mean, the flip side is true too. Sometimes you have to add pieces. If you are constantly photoshopping out stray hairs, go get a hairstylist. Mm-hmm. Or if you're trying to photoshop out, problems with the skin, skin issues that could have been resolved maybe with a little bit of foundation for even skin tones, get a makeup artist. Or if you're digging through wardrobe trying to cobble together three shoes, which I've had models arrive with one and a half pairs of shoes. So literally three shoes. Now, what are you going to do? Well, you can't do anything. If you don't have shoes, you don't have shoes. You're going to shoot barefoot. Well, if that's an issue, go get a stylist. Make sure that you have shoes. Make sure you have clothes. But the point of it is save yourself some time. Foresee the issues that you're going to have coming up. And then be accurate and precise about removing those, because that's a systematic error. You could have. It's not random that she showed up with three shoes. You didn't talk to her about shoes. If you didn't talk to her about shoes or skin or stretch marks or your hair, that's not her fault. You can't blame her,
When does this take place? When you're reflecting on a shoot? Like if you're a photographer and when is it, so throughout the process?
Well, yeah, it's something that you learn after.
Where can I improve? Like what was a failure? Or what was
the
success?
It's when you're looking at it as a retoucher and you're pulling your hair out for having made those mistakes. Whether it was picking a model with stretch marks, bad skin, or not having hair, not having makeup, or having too much hair, having too much makeup, or having too much styling. Those are all things that in retrospect, and for me, it's going to be in the retouch process, that I'm going to say, you know what, next time around, we're not doing it that way.
Yeah.
And that's getting more precise to the stripping down the parts that you don't need or adding the proper parts that you do need to create a more precise equation or model or forecast that generates the proper final product. So those are, I don't want to dwell on that because I think we've talked a lot about models and choosing them, but that's a little bit of insight where, precision plays its part, a certain part on everything. As far as retouching is concerned, dodging and burning requires a ton of precision, a ton of fine, sensitive hand-eye coordination. And I know not everybody has that. I always suggest that people buy Wacom tablets or any tablet whatsoever and not do this by mouse or by trackpad because it's just not as precise. You can't get into certain areas that you could otherwise with a pen and a tablet. You have to also develop that sensitivity to see different shades of light. If you don't see that, your precision is going to be poor because you're not recognizing when it needs to be dodged versus when it needs to be burned. So if you're talking about uneven skin tones, it's really obvious when she's got a blotchy, big, dark patch of skin, that is the equivalent of an oversized mole, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, fine, let's get rid of that. But when it's a very faint and subtle difference between, hey, there's a darker patch here, but it kind of like blends out, but it's definitely darker. Having the precision and having the eye to see that and recognize that means then being able to take it out. But if you don't recognize it, if you aren't precise about those things, you're going to miss it. Likewise, if you're not precise about color cast, like a lot of times makeup artists will... Historically, I've seen green makeup, like the color. I don't know what it is.
A tint to it almost.
A green tint. The rest of their body is fine.
Yeah.
But they've only worked on the face. And I don't understand how they blended green into the face. And now, like, if you hold up her arm next to her face, it's like two completely different colors. I'm like, you didn't make this any better. Yeah. You made it worse.
Well, that's scary too. If you see that, you're like, oh my God, what else do I not? What else are you missing? If I can see this clear as day from across the room that her face looks a little bit more green.
I pointed it out and they're like, yeah, some makeup artists just don't see it. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, like that is bad news. So, I mean, that's just an example. I'm not pinpointing makeup artists. And certainly it's only a small subset of bad ones that I'm talking about. I'm talking about having the eye to
being
see
aware
color cast differences.
The details.
For example, it's just it's just a matter of fact that when people sweat, when people get flush, that their faces, the blood that travels, you know, we have very fine capillaries in mm-hmm. our faces, so the blood travels closer to the skin. Therefore, when we blush or when we get embarrassed or when we get flushed with heat, our faces change a different color. And if you don't recognize that and you don't address that in retouching, dude, that's an obvious difference that mm-hmm. other people are going to see, and they're going to judge you. They're going to say, this guy doesn't know how to retouch. This guy didn't see that this is an issue because you're not precise. Because you said, I'm done. I'm going to throw it out there because you didn't give a shit. Well, either you didn't give a shit or you weren't careful enough. And that's what it comes down to. It's attention to detail. And don't let your mistakes be a reflection of you in the public, right?
Yeah. I think it's also kind of being aware that you're not handing this off to somebody else. You're handing it off to you
yep.
to retouch it. Like, how would you want a photographer to send you pictures? Like, well, I think you have to be really aware of what works for you, what's easy for you to Photoshop, what things you don't want to do. And if you're aware of it when you're shooting, it seems like the better you get at that part to recognize that stuff beforehand, yeah. you're giving yourself a doing a great service to yourself.
I've made mistakes. I make mistakes all the time. I still occasionally miss stuff, but when I do miss things, I make a mental note to check next time and then try not to miss them. So it's a learning process that you have to fine tune in order to, and also look, it's a cost benefit analysis. If it's going to take me 5 hours to do it, I probably will not do it mm-hmm. because I'm not going to retouch this picture if it means it's going to take me 40 minutes per picture to get rid of stretch marks. Fine, forget it. I'm gonna pick the pictures where I don't see the stretch marks, or she's rotated, or she's covered, or whatever, because I know that from experience it's gonna take me way too much time. So get rid of it all together, and that is a different type of precision too, because that's the precision that is maximizing your time and being efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of precision is being efficient and not making mistakes, because those mistakes come back and bite you in the ass. Okay, so we've talked about picking models. We've talked about retouching a little bit. You know, funny thing with retouching is that consistency comes from precision. If you're all over the place, you can't be precise or consistent in developing a style. People always want to know, how do you develop a style? Well, first of all, you need to be consistent. You need to be precise. A lot of the things that style comes down to is like a color cast, a way, a different coloring of that image. Now, if I'm not careful about the coloring, one day I use a more portrait type coloring, another day I use a Provia type coloring. Well, those two types of films have very different feels. Portrait's very warm. Provia is kind of cool and very, you know, bluish, greenish, you know, and it looks good for landscapes, but maybe not so good for color tone or skin tone. The point of it being that if you want to develop a specific style, you have to first get very specific about your precision, about being able to do things the same way all the time. Because style has to be consistent.
Yeah. Recognizing those things that make the style, that actually like stand out when you're looking at the pictures. That's interesting.
And I'm not talking about, look, I mean, if one day you want to shoot like a Terry, you know, like Terry Richardson, and another day you want to shoot like, I don't know, so, you know, Steven Meisel, fine, you know, that's a stylistic change. It's a big drastic change. But I'm talking about not being careful. I'm talking about like, you know, doing little things differently here and there, and then where it's like hard for people to pinpoint what it is that you want to do. Like if your lighting can be, for example, some people's lighting, it's just off. Sometimes I get good pictures here. You know, I like when I review photographer portfolios, mm-hmm. I go, hey, you nailed the lighting here. It's great. And then over here, not so much. It's like kind of too dark underneath the eyes, or it's kind of split too much on this side, or it's too, or the picture's too bright here and it's too dark here. Like that's when you kind of get the sense that, oh, this guy's still growing. You know, this guy hasn't,
he can't
seen
recognize
enough.
Maybe he knows that some picture is better than the other, but he doesn't know how to fix that and make it consistent.
That precision, it's like that to me is almost it's not even systematic error, it's actually random error, where the balls are just way 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 too far from the hole. It's just all over around hole. Every now and then you'll get a few that are really close to the hole, but it's just kind of like a shotgun blast, you know, all over the place,
right?
And that's a reflection of the tool, which is the photographer being not really a precise tool, you know, just kind of rough, really rough around the edges. Yeah. And that person just needs a lot of time. You know, that photographer needs a lot of time. Just keep shooting. Start bringing that blast, you know, radius very, very close to where you're sniping rather than shotgun blasting, you know.
I think that's smart. I think that's how you become consumerly at looking at it as a consumer. When I'm looking at a photographer's portfolio and we want to work with that photographer, I think consistency is the most important part. If you have two cool shots in your portfolio that I think has amazing light, but everything else isn't great, what am I going to expect out of that test? Or what am I going to expect out of...
They probably won't choose you as a photographer if they see that you're inconsistent. People...
Builds confidence.
Yeah, people get chosen when they have a very clear message. And one of the things, and this is not really precision, but when you're doing wildlife photography and architectural stuff and also like landscape and this and that, and then you do fashion, people get really confused because they think that you're all over the place. And there's a reason for that. People want to hire people who are very, very clear and only do one thing really, really well, because that's the thing that I need you for.
Yeah.
I can't use you for wildlife photography and all the other types, but because I need you for this, and I want to know that you're the best at this and not just the jack of trades of everything. So, on the rare occasion, of course, there's always going to be that one magazine that does like five different things, and they'll fine. You'll be a perfect fit for that. But that's definitely the exception to the rule and very, very unlikely. So be specific, be clear, be sensitive about what you're trying to achieve. And going back to forecasting, I was talking about like, you know, being able to gauge what kind of effort, how much you sweat, given the temperature, humidity, the distance that you're going to be running. All of that can be applied to photography as well. Because if I'm going out to El Matador and I want to shoot the rocks, I'm not shooting the rocks if I have to get in like waist deep in the water.
Mm-hmm.
It's retarded. And the model doesn't want to get wet unless, of course, it's a specifically like getting, you know, like in the water shoot. But if I want to shoot the rocks, hey, I'm going to do myself a huge favor if I'm precise about what time I go. What is the tide doing? Is it low tide is low tide. Low tide could be 3 feet.
Yeah,
low tide
yeah.
could be 4 feet.
Yeah.
That's still technically low tide. Or it could be -1 feet. And now you have to know, when is that rock exposed? Okay, because if you decide you're going to go, hey, this is low tide. Yeah, it says low tide. And you just go out and it's like 3 feet of water still. Yeah, it's low tide, but it's not going to expose that rock. You're not going to be able to shoot it unless you want to get wet. So precision has to do with forecasting. It has to do with you and me sitting in front of the computer, looking at Google Maps, cross-referencing Picasa, then cross-referencing SunCalc and knowing where the sun and how it travels across the sky during that time of the year, during that time that we're going to that location. I couldn't do the whole Lautner House shoot if it weren't for the fact that I basically blueprinted that entire house on paper, on Google Maps, knowing where the sun was going to travel over the specific rooms that I wanted to shoot at.
Mm-hmm.
Before even walking into the house, I knew where all the rooms were. I knew where the sun was going to be. That's precision.
Yeah.
It's also a lot of planning, obviously. But a lot of that forecasting and being precise about it, of course, and of course it's a feedback loop where if you screw it up, if you did it wrong, change that model. I'm not talking about the fashion model. I'm talking about change that mental model. Change the equation that you're plugging those variables into.
Mm-hmm.
The next time you do it, get more precise. Don't go there when it's overcast, or try to figure a day where it's not overcast, or try to figure, like, if you got to know that the sun is traveling in a different arc during winter than it does during summer. If you don't know that, you failed.
Mm-hmm.
That's imprecision. So a lot of what we do as athletes and being very good about gauging our abilities is also applicable in being very well prepared for any specific shoot. And that's something that I want you guys to remember, you know, going into your shoots. You know, the whole precision thing, you know, like retouching, being precise, it's also allowed me to do things. You know, I always tell photographers, you got to know your camera like the back of your hand. You got to be able to do shit like blindfolded. You got to be able to change settings. You got to do it on the fly because everything is very, very run and gun. The more precise you are, the more second nature you are about your camera, the more that you can be precise about the flow of that shoot and keeping that momentum, making sure you have your model's attention, making sure you don't ice her and like make her stand in front on set while you're messing around with lights because you can't get it right. Those things can be erased as factors that can be drawbacks to your shoot, that can mess up your shoot. So the better you know your camera, the better you know your lighting, the better you know even the natural light that we have in the studio, you know, what time that we're going to get it, how much we're going to get, at what angle we're going to get.
Then you can focus your energy on the things that
matter.
Yeah, that you now you have the next phase. Okay, what else can I change now? What
it's
else
a pyramid.
Can I set? Yeah.
Because you got to keep going up, 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 up. Like when I had the Next 7, I had it's a Sony camera, but they didn't have any lenses, so I was using Canon lenses. As a result of using Canon lenses on a Sony body, I was forced to do manual focus. Okay, if I didn't know my camera really well, it's really tough to try to manual focus my camera while I'm trying to mess around with the camera settings. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I've got a model who I have to direct in front of me. I'm looking for lighting. I'm looking to see that all the wardrobe is right. And then if I want to add one more element and like throw a prism or a piece of glass or a gel in front of the lens and try to make it a little bit more, you know, infuse a little bit of artistic, you know, flair in quite literally the sense of actual light flares, you know, or like a, you know, to make it kind of light leak, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
I've got all these things going on. If I'm not precise about each one of these things, it's all going to hell in a handbasket really fast. She's going to be like, what the hell are you doing? You're fiddling around with this thing and that thing, and then you're running around like a chicken with its head cut off because you can't get the lighting right. You know, I don't trust this guy.
Lost her confidence.
Totally.
Loses your confidence once you can see it in their face.
Totally lost her confidence. Or the battery situation. If that happened more often, I'd be the guy that didn't charge its batteries. I'd be known as that guy, you know? Or I'd be known as the guy who forgets his camera at the model's house if that happened more often than once. So fortunately, I mean, those have only happened each one time, and that's a precision thing that I would never let myself... First of all, I beat myself over it over and over and again. And then secondly, it's just not in my nature to make those type of mistakes to begin with. It's already a very unique day when that happens to me because I pride myself on not making mistakes. But the point of it is, you know, there's a lot going on. Control for the stuff that you can control for, so that you can focus on the stuff that really matters. The expression, the direction. It's hard to talk to a model when you're talking to yourself.
It's almost like being never satisfied with the current project. Like the current job that you've just done, okay, what can change? Because there's always something that could get better or improved.
Right.
Because I don't know. I don't know whose style at this point where they feel content with what they have.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's always something that can be a little bit better, just like sports, and just like anything else.
It is like sports. But then there are guys who will play a game and they'll be like, oh, that was great, and then not really practice for the next one. Mm-hmm. You see? And so there's a difference between a Kobe Bryant and someone else, you know?
Right.
So, and what is that difference? Well, the difference is Kobe is very, very precise, and he'll take 10,000 shots a day, and he'll just keep shooting, he'll shoot, and he'll shoot, and he'll shoot, and his accuracy is pinpoint, whereas another guy, you know, maybe he only shoots 1,000 shots. Well, that's the difference in personality, that's the difference in their, how they treat precision, and how they treat what they can plan for. So for the guys out there that are listening, I think they can do themselves a huge favor by neutralizing those things that are systematic error, and then also getting better at the stuff that is random error. You know, just get better at everything. Get more control. Just it's all about control at the end of the day as a photographer. I mean, you can't control for a lot of things. And surely... And this is probably going to be another podcast, but surely you do have to let go sometimes.
Yeah.
The point of preparation is so that you can be as well prepared for when you step on stage, when you step on set.
To be improvisational.
But at that point, you have to let everything go. You can, you know, when they say, when you golf, you know, you practice your swing, on the driving range. But when you stand in front of the ball, you have to let all of that go. You just have to
have faith in your swing.
It has to be natural. It has to flow. Otherwise, the more you think about it, the more it's going to fall apart.
It seems like you're saying, you know, raising your own bar on your own level of expectations for yourself. Like never looking out, looking at your own skills and saying, okay, what can I improve? How can I make this easier for myself? So that you're always raising your own bar instead of just for the client. Like you can promise a client anything or even a model, but really, what can you do? What do you feel confident doing? And how can you make yourself better for you first before anybody else?
Exactly. I was going to talk about organic mutation and when mistakes are good, but I'm going to leave that for the next podcast because this was actually a really good conversation that I had with the workshop photographer that we just had a couple days ago. So focus on precision. Again, there's a, and this is a reference that I'm going to have in the blog, but I'm sorry, on the podcast, but there is a blog post that I remember writing, and it was about how 90% times 90% times 90% times 90% times 90% comes out to be like 35% or something like that. And the reason I wrote that was because people will say, I've had photographers come in, they go, oh yeah, I light like that. Oh yeah, I shoot like that. Oh yeah, my models kind of look the same. I don't understand why my pictures don't look like yours. How come they're so far off? But that's the thing. If everything's just off a little bit, it's like me walking in the wrong direction for 400 yards looking for my glider that was 2 degrees off.
If they can't see those differences, though, they're lost. Like,
the game is already over. Yeah. If you think that we are doing it all the same,
right,
then you've already missed the point because you're not sensitive enough to see those little things. So I want to leave you guys with that. I want you guys to listen to the next podcast, which is the organic mutation. And also, if you have a chance, read the blog post that is referenced in this one. And thanks for listening. And we will talk to you guys all very soon. Thanks.